Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric. Joining me to talk about families and monsters and all sorts of things today is Michael Kester.
That's right. I'm going to go a whole episode without making a single Kesha joke. About?
Go on.
Well, I don't know. Are we ready to tell people what movies we're doing already?
I believe the movies today are The Purge and We Are What We Are.
That's right. And I'm not going to make a Kesha joke about the latter.
Okay. Listen, there's going to be spoilers, all right? And if you don't like spoilers, you can use chapters. Or if you're impatient, you can use chapters. Or for reasons all your own that you don't have to tell us, you can use chapters. So, you know, look them up on the internet, figure out how they work, and use them to skip into the movies, which I think we can just start right now.
Yeah, so let's talk about The Purge. I'm just going to explain a little background on how The Purge made its way into my life. I think it's safe to say that I go see movies at the theater a little bit more often than you.
Right. I've seen about three of those since I moved here, actually.
Well, and a natural symptom of seeing movies in the theater is, and this is one of the things that I think is probably would drive me out of the theater, is having to sit through the same fucking trailers every week.
Yeah, sure.
Because if I go see multiple movies in a day, I do my infamous Triple Tuesdays in Chicago because movies cost $6 then. And I see fucking the same trailer three times in a row. But The Purge was one of those trailers. And whenever you get a new horror trailer, you know, I always get like a little chubby. So The Purge starts, there's skulls and violence and the government has blah, 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 known as The Purge and violence and blood and people swinging bats and firebombs. And oh my God, this movie's, wait, we're going to be in a house the whole time? One house? You realize you just set up one of the coolest premises and then you put it in a house.
It's funny you say that because that's one of the things that sold me on it.
Well, okay, so The Purge had then, this was a while ago because, you know, the sequel is upon us. And so The Purge came and went and I completely ignored it because I was so disappointed that the premise happened with sitting people in a house. And then they released the trailer for The Purge Anarchy, the trailer of which is the sequel for The Purge. And that went on to highlight what was clearly outside of a house. That is the best I can tell you. I will not spoil it, for I have not seen the movie. But as you know, and as I know, Eric, a couple of completionists we be.
Yeah.
And so upon knowing I wanted to see The Purge Anarchy, I decided, well, one must watch the initial film. So I got my hands on the Ethan Hawke, Lena Headey family joint, The Purge, and went ahead and watched it.
You're forgetting about Hamster Bot. That's also a critical part of the family.
Point being, I had only expected nothing from The Purge because all it needed to be, Eric, all it needed to be was the movie before The Purge Anarchy. That is sure. Literally right. All I needed it to be.
Right.
And I can tell you by the title that it was that film.
I'm in the same spot on Wrong Turn. I just want you to know, because you are eternally disappointed that I refuse to watch Wrong Turn 2 before I see Wrong Turn, which I never get around to. And we, as of yet, have not put on our show.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm in the exact same place. And if The Purge can do it, God damn it, I have faith for Wrong Turn.
Well, my point,
you,
and this,
however,
my
you're
point,
not.
And this may be different than your discovery upon your own introspective journey, is that The Purge was totally worth my time.
Awesome.
That The Purge was far and away more inventive and creative. And I mean, it experimented with so much. I feel like The Purge was the sequel to a movie that never happened. That somebody went, okay, well, we've seen what happens in the streets, but what does a single family do in the night of The Purge?
Yeah, right.
It's like they're going backwards.
This has thought experiment written all over it.
Absolutely.
You know, brainstorming session through and through. You start with the concerns that people have and everybody's talking about security systems. It seems a very double feature that we would come on here and talk about the actual setup of the premise and the rules, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's important.
So, I mean, you get this text scroll and kind of all of this government
narration. It's the beginning of Escape from New York, but
yeah. Now. Well, what's funny about this, and this is one of the things I love The Purge for, so we're in our not too distant post-apocalyptic style future.
Sure.
When the government controls blah, blah, founding fathers, blah, right. blah, new America.
It's after China wins. I think it's the America after China wins.
And in this grim horror scenario we're building, crime is down to 1%. Ooh, very scary. Wait, what? Hold on, let's go back. Crime is down to 1%?
Right.
That's not usually where we start these
sure.
movies.
Well, and unemployment is especially far down too.
Whoa, unemployment is sinking rapidly. The downward spiral of unemployment. Religion is all but disappeared and people are holding hands in the street and mm-hmm. gay men can kiss without the Pope.
Gay men can kiss without the Pope telling them they can't smoke weed. Right, exactly.
Right, right. With their firearms, I believe. Mm-hmm. All right, so we're in
all I want is to live in a country where gay married men can protect their weed fields with a shotgun.
Thank you.
That's all I want from the United States.
Yeah, so I actually feel like maybe part of our love for this movie is we don't realize to everyone else on planet Earth, this is that libertarian nightmare
right.
future movie. Oh, you know, The Purge where libertarians
sure.
rule the Earth and that's why they kill everybody once a year.
Right.
As far as I know, that's not on the libertarian platform right now to mm-hmm. create an annual event where we all murder each other. And I actually want to talk to you a lot about the morality in that situation.
Sure.
But first, only certain classes of weapon. Mm-hmm. That's a rule.
Yeah.
And no government officials of rank 10 or higher.
Right. Which is
are
important.
Are these rules cop-outs? Are these,
no.
So you think these are important?
I think that they're important statutes because, and here's why. Since the Purge is technically a voluntary thing, think of it like akin to fireworks on the 4th of July.
Right, or paying your taxes.
Sure, yeah. But more akin to fireworks on the 4th of July.
Guess who's getting audited this year? That's God, I hope no one listens to this show.
On the American Independence Day, for any listeners who may not be familiar, we shoot exploding flowers into the sky. And everybody goes, ooh, and then claps.
Right.
That's what we do to celebrate the fact that we are a free nation.
Things do not look well for humanity.
But here's why it's so perfectly analogous. If you don't want to go see the 4th of July, you don't care about the fucking fireworks, you sit in your goddamn house and you watch, you know, you do a John Waters marathon and you eat popcorn, right? Fuck you, 4th of July. I don't give a shit. Except... you're going to hear the fireworks unless you live so far away from society.
Oh man, I do not like where this is going.
That little aspect of the 4th of July is going to be there.
Uh-huh.
Unless you happen to have the money to soundproof your whole home to keep the 4th of July out for a nice, calm Independence Day. But that would be totally ruined if... your neighbor could set off a firework. Now that's a little closer, you know, that's a little bit, what do you do about your neighbor? So there's a law. Neighbors cannot shoot off fireworks. That's unfair.
Are getting to the part where I can't stab a state senator in the eyeball?
Well, my point is that in order for there to be this kind of event, there has to be the freedom to be uninvolved. Okay.
Okay.
And in order to guarantee uninvolvement, I need to know that my president, I'm not going to need to vote tomorrow. Not that I fucking would.
Okay.
But I'm not going to need to figure out who's going to be president tomorrow. And I'm not going to need to worry about somebody in a tank bulldozing my armor-plated house.
Uh-huh.
I need to know that there is an option to not purge. It's supposed to be optional. That is the operative aspect of the purge, is the fact that it is technically, although not practically, optional.
It's optional unless your neighbors really don't want it to be optional for you.
Right.
It's optional to not kill other people.
I think that's what the film does so fantastically, is they present it as optional and put you in the universe with the family who isn't participating.
Right, right.
That's one of the most interesting things, because automatically it raises the question, and it answers it three ways. Okay, so it is optional. What if somebody has snuck into your home before the purge and intends to purge? they cover that.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you accidentally become involved with an outside force strong enough to enter your purgeless zone?
Sure.
What if there is a conspiracy to make sure you participate in the purge?
Hmm.
And they cover basically all three options. I honestly, off the top of my head, can't think of any other way to force somebody non-participating to participate in the purge, except for, you know, the circumstance of, oh shit, I didn't get home in time.
And then when you say conspiracy, you're speaking about the neighbors.
I'm speaking about the neighbors.
Which, yeah, I guess it's a bunch of people getting together, hatching a plan that you don't know about to
yes.
kind of draw you into, yeah, all right, I'll call that a conspiracy, sure. The thing that this made me think about immediately is they raised this thing, and we've talked about it a little bit in other horror movies, where there is a monster inside all of us
sure.
that wants to maim, rape, and kill.
Right. The need to purge, I think, is
and I'm so glad that we have horror movies, because that is an outlet for us to get those feelings out.
Horror movies and Grand Theft Auto.
So I'm starting to get a little concerned how often this excuse is used.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can't tell by my summation of this idea, I don't feel this way at all.
Sure. No, neither do I. I think it's total garbage.
And the film just presents it as fact.
Sure.
We're all keeping these violent, awful urges at bay 24/7.
To go back to what I was saying, it presents it as fact, but not unanimous fact, because there are those, again, who do not participate in the purge because they don't have the need to purge.
Right.
But what's even scarier about the notion of the need to purge is the phrase that the cosmopolitan teenagers use, our right to purge.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
that's a chilling phrase.
Well, then you get into the part where the government has endorsed this and it's sort of pushed people towards the idea.
Right.
But I'm still stuck back at, I mean, who are these monsters who keep saying things like this? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That we have to get it out of people's systems some way. And
right.
I kind of feel like it's tongue in cheek with horror directors when they say their movies are outlets for,
sure,
you know, the repressed whatever that people carry right. with them. They're just coming up with excuses to say in front of, you know,
right.
when they're put on trial for weird things or called mm-hmm. out by the MPAA or whatever.
Yeah.
But when the movie presents this scenario where it goes, it even one step beyond, it goes, and now, thankfully, the law says that one night a year, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of extrapolate that to say the only thing stopping people from doing this currently is the fact there is a law in place.
Right. I refer to that from a religious perspective as the God leash.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Which is, why don't you kill people? Oh, because of the fifth commandment.
It's been a long time since we've talked about that, but I remember you and I having yeah. these discussions. Yeah. I don't feel that way in
no.
the slightest.
No.
Yeah. I mean, we shouldn't put that on the movie. It's not saying that all atheists are murderers and killers. It's not making any comments about that.
It's raising the question. That's all. It's just raising interesting questions. And it's, I think we can safely write it off by saying not our universe. Right.
right.
Because
thankfully crime is still above 1% here.
Well, when a film is clearly set on Earth in the near present day, I think that a lot of people generally throw out the same kinds of suspensions of disbelief that they might have for a sci-fi movie or a supernatural horror flick or a
mm-hmm.
historical fiction type movie.
Totally.
I think that people need to realize that just because something is set in the present day, it's not saying this is your Earth.
Sure.
It's saying this is something that happens in a universe awfully similar to this one.
Well, and they're being a little cheeky with it too.
Absolutely.
The place that I actually have these intellectual kind of problems in my head, where I'm not sure how I feel, is figuring out what the right thing to do is then in that universe.
They really hit that question pretty hard too.
So there's this relative kind of morality that shows up. If we jump to the point where the government has not mandated, but has created this and says several times, we encourage you guys to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Children are taught in school, and we can assume encouraged in school to do this. People are raised to say, go out and do this thing. Imagine at that point, we've accepted all those things and this has been going on for years. And now we find ourselves in the house and a man has come in and we have him taped to a chair. And there are people outside who say they're going to kill us unless we let them slaughter this man. Morally, I'm not really sure, given those circumstances, what the right thing in that particular world is to do.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think you have to weigh human life, right? And I think that you and I have this dilemma, especially because as humanists, a human life weighs infinite pounds.
Sure.
And so what does five human lives weigh? Five times infinite pounds?
I see what you're saying.
I mean, is there a difference at that point? If something, you know, the astronomical weight of giving someone up for murder, is it really any less to defend them for that many more hours, maybe save their life, but risk the lives of other humans? Where,
sure,
to me, that is, I think, the blurriest line.
Right.
I remember saying after the film ended that if the purge truly were to happen, I would spend the first purge hiding in my room, terrified, and right, probably immediately the second purge hunting purgers.
Oh, interesting.
I think would be the first thing I would do. Which, again, you have
to... It only takes one purge for you to come right around on slaughtering people.
That's the thing is...
The first time you're like, whoa, guys, I can't believe this is the world we live in. And the second time you're like, fuck it, this is the world I live in.
Well, no, I think because I would feel so fearful and I would realize that I was certainly not the only one feeling that fearful. And I would try to get a band of people together and just stop people from purging. If nonviolently right, was the option, obviously that would be the thing. But where's the morality there? You get into the notion of the right to purge. Mm-hmm. If I go out with a baseball bat because it's a blunt object and maybe non-lethal, totally lethal, maybe non-lethal. And I go out there and anybody who's chasing anyone I think is innocent, I beam them in the head with the baseball bat and I yell at them, don't purge, you know, right, or some fucking, I don't know. I don't have a catchphrase because I'm not a fucking superhero.
Right. Your catchphrase would be shut up crime, I believe. Is
shut up crime.
Shout at them.
Exactly.
Right.
But my point is that even more but moralistic?
Do you not remember the moral lesson we learned from,
right,
that movie?
Am I any more
you
moral?
You can't go around hitting people with a wrench, telling them not to do bad things.
Right. And so, but at the same time it's that adage of the only thing evil needs to succeed is for good men to do nothing.
Sure.
And then, but that's also, you know, that's juxtaposed against the awful notion of thought crime.
Right.
The purge, I think, is such an interesting moral gray area. Because anybody with any wherewithal can argue for why or why not they are allowed to do what they're doing from a moral perspective.
Well, again, and I would make that jump once this is a world we live in where this has already been happening. I think the first time this happens, to be a good human, you have to revolt against the people,
sure,
who are setting this up.
Sure.
Or we can all, I mean, I don't know exactly what the reaction is the first time. And I also think that's a great movie idea right there, is the first time there's...
They'll get around to it. The Purge,
you know,
Zero,
the purge,
it'll be called.
Right. How do people react to what kind of, I mean, certainly civil disobedience is an idea, right? Mm-hmm. Well, what if the government says do this and just none of us do it? And that'll probably break down. I also want to know what really caused the government to, how the fuck did that ever get through? In today's America, we can't even legalize pot everywhere.
Right.
And somehow in the Purges America, it's fine to just kill everybody as long as it's only once a year.
That's also interesting, is that the Purge legalizes everything. It's not just violent crime.
Right, right.
You can walk around with an open beer and a joint and not get arrested. Granted, you know, anything you do that isn't murder, you're risking being murdered.
Sure. I think it's funny that the movie, I mean, it makes sense because it's a movie, so it's going to jump right to murder. I'm actually pretty surprised it doesn't go a lot of the other areas.
Sure. Looting. Looting is a huge one.
looting. I thought it might get a little rapey
sure.
at one point, just because it's a horror film.
Sure.
And once you're legalizing terrible things, that's just kind of where I expect it to go.
I think that rape is probably the step beyond murder. Although I don't know.
You're saying sequel.
No, I'm saying
Purge 3, the rape.
I'm saying whichever one is straight to DVD, straight to video, is going to be the rape one. The rape purge will not be theatrically screened.
I feel like there are even other genres we can move into with this kind of premise. If
sure.
you can break any law, there are other laws that make completely different movies.
Sure.
I mean, you think about, you know, porn laws, or we joked about taxes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we could put the Purge Day also on tax day, that would work out really well.
Or if you just happen to have expert levels of hacking, you just wait for the purge, hack right in, delete everybody's, you know, delete Sally Mae from
right.
the face of the earth.
I don't, you know nothing about computers, do you?
You delete Sally Mae.
You need to hack into Sally Mae and hit delete, but make sure to empty your trash so Sally Mae is gone permanently. That's how you're gonna
exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, no, but that's a good point. I mean, if you go and steal, if you rob Fort Knox the night of the purge, do you get to keep the money?
Right.
And do you have to write that money? Like, does that go in your gross income for the year? Or does it not count because it was on Purge
Day? That's probably why they go with murder, is because murder has
very
few numerical implications, aside from fewer people, more jobs.
See, they don't have the respect for the audience to understand the tax code.
Right.
They go, nah, people won't be able to follow this.
Sure.
I think you could tell, I mean, statutory rape is another one. I think it's really interesting because there are entire movies that deal with the idea of two people who are in complete consent, in love with each other, can't have sex because they're different age ranges. I mean, you could tell like a compelling, sweet story about statutory rape with mm-hmm. The Purge. You know, the amount of just this premise they've developed of you can break laws one day a year. What would you do? I mean, that's a whole landscape of movies that could come out of that. I don't really have an answer to go back to our morality question. I don't
right.
know. I mean, it's something that's also an area where I think, this is why I love thought experiments. I think you could spend forever thinking about this.
Right.
And hopefully you would never be in a situation where anything like this would come up. But being a good human being requires playing by social guidelines. There's also, I try and develop an analog when something like this happens.
Mm-hmm.
I try and think, well, where is this situation? How can I create a kind of metaphor to maybe make this a little more recognizable?
4th of July.
Not 4th of July. No, but I mean like, you know, like a tyrannical government or something.
Sure.
Like you're in another country and the government says, you know, we're going to do something obscene. We're going to do a terrible thing. And do you resist that or do you obey your government? What if your government threatens your family if you resist it? Where are the moral lines there? And I think those questions are already pretty fucking hard that, you know, by the time you get to the purge, you're in a place where it's almost impossible for me to deal with that morally.
Right, right.
And the movie is still kind of doing these, it's expecting the audience to do it from their gut a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a decision in here where they have to make the right choice about what to do with their captor.
Sure.
But that's where I start thinking about this because I don't really know what the fuck the right choice is.
Right.
Do you put your family in jeopardy because a guy snuck into your house?
I don't know.
Because he wasn't playing by the mandated rules of the government? It feels like the right choice, but it's also like in your head, how could that be the right choice?
Here's how I feel. And I think that the movie does a really good job of, it's actually a sidestep, but it's close to coming to a moralistic decision. You ask everyone involved, you ask both children and your wife, shall you lay down your life for this man?
Mm-hmm.
And they all say, okay. And then you ask yourself, shall I also lay down my life? And you yourself say yes. And then you ask the man, shall we lay down our lives for you? And he says, yeah.
So when all else fails morally, democracy.
Well, I think that everybody
take
should
a vote.
I think that everybody should have this. Now we're getting into the fucking euthanasia, but everybody should be able to decide when they're okay sacrificing their own life.
Right.
In that situation. And, but I wouldn't say democracy, because if one person comes out and says no, then you're back to having no real answer because you can't rightfully force them to
die.
You
want a unanimous decision here.
Right. So I think what the film does is it kind of deals with, well, what if and what if not? And okay, no time to make a decision. Let's turn into badass killer dad. And then the film gets violent as fuck, just like we like it. And there's fucking steak and eggs all over the floor full of people's body parts. And then the stakes just keep getting raised until what I think is possibly the best climax in the film, which is the scene where everybody sits at the table and no one's going to purge. You all right. sit there and you don't purge. And then when somebody gives her lip, she smashes their face into the table and says, "No fucking purging."
Yeah, it's such a good, the movie has a really strange sense of humor.
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite moments from it. So if we could make the purge this morally complex, I'm actually afraid of our conversation for We Are What We Are. Let's talk about the reveal of the thing.
Okay.
So use chapters, skip the fuck out of here before Netflix ruins this movie for you.
Yeah, so Netflix has in their 2-sentence description of We Are What We Are, father tries to keep his daughter safe because they're fucking cannibals. Oh my God, they're cannibals. that's the basic Netflix description. And
sure.
So I mean, you and I probably both came to know this movie before Netflix brought it upon us. And that's because of the people behind the movie, which we'll get to. But I think that I knew going into the movie, We Are What We Are. Okay, so it's about identity. It's a horror movie. So this is about a family of, what, witches?
No, Wolfmen's, not a family of witches.
Wolfmen's.
No, although I do think it shares a lot of common ground with Lords of Salem that we just talked about. But yeah, you know, there's 2 covers for this.
Right.
So the one I have, although I guess the episode isn't out because, you know, we're recording it right now. But the cover I plan to use is the one without the chili in the bowls.
That's good.
But there is also a chili in the bowl with bloody handwriting one that I feel like tips the hand just a little bit too much.
Well, I think that going into the movie, because I experienced it, I was thinking to myself, okay, are we talking vampires or cannibals? God, I hope we're not talking vampires. I'm so sick of fucking vampires. And the film is unfolding, and I honestly think pretty early on it becomes very obvious that it's not vampires.
Sure.
Right around daylight.
Right, right.
But I think that it's really interesting that because of the cinematic climate with vampires right now, anything can be fucking vampires. I can't tell you.
They could just appear at any time.
I can't.
In any place.
I can't tell you. I literally can't tell you because of spoilers. But how many new horror films have come out in recent history that I watch and go, oh my God, I fucking hate vampires, only to find out there are no vampires in the movie. thought this movie was about vampires.
That anecdote wasn't even going where I thought it was going. That's funny.
And We Are What We Are is, again, I came to the movie completely rooting for it because of Jim Mickle, but I didn't know if it was cannibals or vampires, and I was pleasantly surprised to find out it was the former because, one, I'm bored with vampires, and 2, I love me some fucking cannibals.
Well, you don't see cannibals nearly as much.
Nearly enough,
and I still
Eric.
Feel like there's a lot of area to explore with that idea. We haven't bankrupt the collective imagination like we have with some of these other monsters we've been doing for years and years. Not that there aren't still good movies coming out, you know, whatever, you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I went into this thinking, is this about cannibals? No, it's not. Is it about cannibals? I don't know. So I was just, it was binary for me. Cannibals, yes or no,
right.
was my only. But I don't think that it's completely a secret that this is a movie about cannibalism.
Right.
But at the same time, and this is one of the things I love about it, you get this ongoing imagery in the beginning, the butcher shop and so forth, of cannibals. It's not a secret, but also the movie isn't telling you about it.
Mm-hmm.
So as that's sort of revealed, and it's not a, you know, it's not a big thing at the end that shocks you. It's just kind of, you discover it as it goes along.
Well, there's a big thing at the end that shocks you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but actually shocks you, not something you thought was coming the entire time.
It's not a twist.
Right. Well, and that's my point, is there's never really a scene that goes, confirmation, cannibals. That's probably going to come at a different point for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, before they even start the movie,
right.
people who knew about the fucking Mexican version or Spanish version or whatever came out. Right. I didn't see it, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't one of those people. People who know how to read and watched it on Netflix, mm-hmm. also illiterate, so that didn't help me.
I just don't read descriptions.
That's the way to do it, man. That's the way to do it. Hit that play button right away. Don't look. But I like that because, you know, you're almost getting these, it adds more mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And not just because you don't know cannibals or not, but also the reveal of this disease, which is another one of my favorite parts.
Oh, I love the scientific treatment of cannibalism in the film. I think that that is one of the most ingenious aspects of the film. And I also think that from a filmmaking perspective, casting Michael Parks in that role was the second stroke of genius that came to this film.
Well, casting Michael Parks in anything.
Right. Is... But I mean, casting Michael Parks as the scrappy character you root for.
And not the cannibal.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, I know. Because this movie could have had Michael Parks and just gone at the completely opposite direction.
Something more along the lines of Red State.
Exactly. Exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, the casting of this was great.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, and so I think not even just the scientific explanation, but the way they're slowly revealing it to you, it's another one of those things where you don't get halfway through the movie and go, oh, and also the cannibalism is actually a disease, and that's why the thing and the reveal and whatever. You see that from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There's some weird thing happening to this woman, and you don't immediately understand her condition or the connection it has. It adds an element of intrigue where you're trying to figure out how does all the shaky hand stuff
mm-hmm.
that the movie keeps showing us really connect back to this? And it does so in a naturalistic way, and that ends up being how they connect the pieces, which I think is great. What the movie does above everything else for me is atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's both in comparison to Jim Mickle's other stuff, but also what makes this a really good cannibal film or a really good kind of monster film is keeping it rooted. Part of it's the setting. It's in Catskill.
Yeah.
It's this mountainous area. It's becoming like a hot spot for genre stuff.
Yeah.
But when we talked about city suburb dangerous, this is, you know, this is a place you could believe that this would happen, right? So it grounds it in reality.
The kind of place where you have a river in your backyard.
Totally. And also a place where you can't tell if it's 2013 or 1845.
Right.
So it lets you build your own setting from scratch. It's not like our world. So the director, the storytellers, they make the rules here. And that's what makes it so disturbing is going, this is a real world, but we're not sure exactly what kind of world it is.
Mm.
And the more we find out, it's like our world. It's like, you know, as we talked about in The Woman, kind of that detached area of society that has cars and cell phones. So they live today. It's just disturbing how much they're not living in today.
Right.
And so you can understand the mentality they have, and especially, you know, the way Mickle ropes religion into it
mm-hmm.
to give you kind of an idea of this blind faith of their, well, ceremony, I guess, tradition, really.
Right. I think tradition.
Yeah, this is the way it's always been. You get the family Bible stuff. You really have no doubt that this is a thing that's going on, and it's terrifying.
Right.
And so the stuff that's really haunting for me is the use of subtlety, which is a little bit different than, I mean, not totally different, but a little bit than what Mickle's been doing in when we talked about Stakeland and when we talked about Mulberry Street.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that's very, you know, very soft. It's very, it takes its time. It lingers in places.
Right.
And that's very unnerving, I think.
Right. Well, I think that what's so interesting about the integration of the family unit into We Are What We Are is that that is a very present thing in Jim Mickle's previous movies.
I didn't think about that. That's true.
I mean, very definitely in Mulberry Street, but also in Stakeland, there's the idea of the mother, father, and daughter, and then the baby and so on.
Yeah.
But it's all kind of the idea of family unit is now put into this hazardous situation, or family unit is now trying to survive this apocalyptic universe.
Right.
And We Are What We Are is really the first time that there's a seamless integration of, what if your family is the problem? What if this unit that that the film is building a house that needs to be protected, and it's going, you know, okay, your family, the family unit is to be preserved. It is a thing of sacredness and preservation.
Right.
But also it is a huge problem for the rest of the world.
Sure.
Unlike the other films, which are the complete opposite. The family unit is to be preserved because of the problems in the outside world.
Sure.
The outside world is the safe place, and your family unit, a thing that must be protected, is also something that needs to be extinguished in order for an encompassing safety to prevail.
It makes your protagonists your villains.
Right. And I think that the integration of the family unit as the villains really makes the slow paced kind of, you know, deliberate softness, like you said, terrifying, because you don't want anybody to lose or win. You're basically sitting there with the characters going, well, we've lost by being born.
Yeah. They're very sympathetic in that way.
Sure. And you don't want them to lose, but you can't accept that they win.
Right.
And that's basically what happens to them. And the only real drawing that the film does from it is to go, well, if there were good cannibals and bad cannibals, let's get rid of the bad cannibals before we get rid of the good cannibals.
You know, the approach to that is to treat the people like people.
Right.
And then let them become their own monsters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, rather than just showing us, introducing us to these characters and saying they are terrible, we spend time with them, we learn about them, they just happen to be fucking cannibals. And the sheer act of cannibalism is going to turn us off as an audience. We're not going to understand that. And so we don't need to be introduced to them as if they're terrible and look at this really gruesome, horrifying thing they're doing. In fact, because they are so, maybe not identifiable, but
human.
But yeah, regular, I don't even want to say regular people, because they're human, because they have emotions and we sympathize and we empathize for them and their family unit and that structure, we fight their battles with them, we suffer their losses with them. And then when we finally get into the gruesome stuff, we go, oh my God, they are monsters. And it's almost like being betrayed by a friend, because we have been walking with these characters, which I think serves to turn your stomach even more than if you just go, this is a film about some cannibals, because you put a wall up if you really feel that going in, whether you know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you are introduced to them, you know, chowing down in the first scene, then you're never going to get to know them in a way where if you're introduced in this very human kind of direction. And I think that also lets you concentrate on why they're cannibals and learn more from the themes of the movie, from things like tradition or family bonds or the impact, you know, a father has on his daughters, raising them alone, or just how hard it is to break things that have always been a certain way.
Right.
The respect children have for their parents, regardless of if their parents are doing insane things, and how hard it is to break out of that. The religious stuff I talked about,
right.
You know, the blind faith and things, that gets to the audience a lot more directly when we're not spending the entire movie just thinking about, oh my God, I can't believe how horrible cannibals are.
Right.
We're going, how did cannibalism do this to our characters, rather than how are our characters doing this to us normal people? So Mikkel worked a lot on the composition with his cinematographer, but he also edited. And the way that the film moves in such a subtle manner also adds a lot of, it harnesses what is raw into the characters. So when you see something that's gruesome, it's not a result that is immediately apparent of the filmmaking. It's not, I'm watching the kind of movie that shocks me or is gruesome or is very violent or bloody. It's it's almost if you were doing a very vanilla documentary and something really heinous happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting to see how much impact a more subtle style of filmmaking has on that, to film this like a slower drama and then to watch the type of event that might happen in a more exploitative horror film. I think it shocks you a lot more because you're all of the rawness comes from the characters. It gives you a lot more intensity to their performances. It also makes the gruesome moments that much more gruesome. Even the smaller ones. I don't think you need as much gore to shock people.
Sure.
The woman's body that's hanging and mm-hmm. mutilated. You know what I mean? We've seen that a million times on Double Feature in ways that are a lot more graphic.
Right.
They don't haunt me like right. they do in this movie. When we have the overabundance that we're getting from the beginning of a film, you know, we almost become a little desensitized by the time
sure.
we...
Sure, well, that's... I mean, it's... I don't know if I would call it desensitized. I'm very abhorrent to that word as a horror film aficionado.
I can see that, yeah.
I think that you become expectant of that based on a film individually. I wouldn't... And knowledge of film.
But, so, you know, the 100th... scarred, chewed up body is not as impactful as the first.
Well, I don't know. It might be. I think that seeing the body in We Are What We Are would have been just as impactful at, I think it's a matter of craft. I think a well-crafted okay. film can impact you no matter what. Whereas I see Hatchet 3 and the first super violent thing to happen, I'm not going to be thinking, holy shit, that was violent. I'm going to be thinking, yay, Hatchet 3. You know what I mean? By having a set expectation.
Yeah.
And I think that the craft in We Are What We Are is by betraying the kind of wan, pale mode of the film
mm-hmm.
and then suddenly bringing the reality of violence into something that is already clearly wan and pale.
I mean, how do you think that impacts the tension? Do you think you're more tense seeing those things less? Does it have to work? Does the scare have to be less proficient after you've wound up so much like that?
Because
I feel like you're right. Hatchet still gives you an hour into Hatchet. You're still going, what the fuck was that?
Right.
But I also feel like they have to throw your face against a belt sander to get that reaction.
Exactly.
Rather than just drawing a red outline mm-hmm. on a naked woman's corpse.
Right. What happens in We Are What We Are with the kind of reveals and aspects of violence, I think is more of, oh my God, I was hoping it wasn't that bad, but it's totally that bad.
Sure.
You're sitting there, like we had said previously, you're kind of rooting for these characters and you're hoping that they've somehow managed to be humane cannibals.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see, no, they're just violent murderers.
Sure.
That I think is the extra blow that makes it harder to see, because it's the reality of these characters being responsible and your it's kind of don't show the monster. I'm afraid it's worse than I thought.
Yeah.
And you see the monster and you go, oh man, it's even worse that it's exactly as bad as I thought.
Well, you get a couple of those moments really distinctly in the film.
Right.
Really any of the cannibalism, any of the eating.
Sure.
The unnerving stuff is there too in the moments when they're not doing that. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like those are the horrifying moments. Everything else is a walk in the park. I think the whole thing is fucking unnerving for the treatment reasons I described earlier.
Right. I think it's in the strength of the characters too. I just think that everything is so grave and heavy.
Well, seeing the younger daughter try to resist,
mm-hmm.
especially the moment where he breaks through that other woman's door or window or whatever right. and kills her, and he calls his son and, you know, he runs up and then she's just sitting on the bed. God, that's one of the worst moments in the film for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, oh, she was so close to getting out and she's trying so hard to be good. And I have no fucking clue if he's just going to snap and flip out as soon as she comes back. But true to the characters and the respect for family, he really does just sympathetically want to kind of like hold her and bring mm-hmm. her back to the home and do what he thinks is right,
right.
Which is all sorts of fucked up. But one of the most horrifying things, so good when a film leaves their most horrifying for the end, is that eating scene.
Yeah, totally.
That ending murder and the screaming part is bad when it first happens and it's unexpected and you kind of go, ugh. But the part that really gets me and makes me go, I'm going to take a break and not watch this again for a long time, is when it kind of goes quiet and they just chew on him mm-hmm. for a while and you just get the quiet chewing sound. There is nothing like it.
Yeah.
It is so incredibly effective. And I like, you know, I like seeing Jim Mickle in this other environment,
oh,
in
yeah.
this really precision, you know, focused kind of where everything is so measured.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny to think about it in comparison to Lords of Salem, because that was Rob Zombie's really measured work.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things we talked about was how Rob Zombie is a very spontaneous filmmaker.
Right.
He does things, you know, he'll come up with ideas the day of shooting and his movies evolve as they're being filmed. Where I think We Are What We Are, everything had to be so close to what was on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot more work for a creative person to try and control themselves. But you can see from this movie the incredible result that comes out of that. I think it's worth the effort. Can we just pat ourselves on the back as well for Jim Mickle?
Yeah, we nailed Jim Mickle.
I feel really validated. People who listen to Double Feature have been paying attention to this guy for years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've been talking about him. People have been emailing us about him. Mulberry Street was a film almost nobody saw
right.
by comparison. And I think the horror community kind of realized who he was during Stakeland. But We Are What We Are gets mainstream press.
Yeah. Well, and his next movie isn't even horror.
Cold in July, isn't that what that's
yeah,
called?
Yeah, Cold in July. It's the adaptation of Cold in July.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it, but people are fucking loving that too.
Yeah.
It's not mainstream Hollywood, mainstream notoriety, but you know, it's making the festivals.
Sure.
And people who don't see horror movies are talking about these things.
He's on his way.
Yeah.
He'll be Peter Jackson before you know it.
But man, you know, I'm so happy about that. He so deserves this. The impact that this movie had, it stuck with me for months.
Mm-hmm.
I have not forgotten scenes. There were scenes I remembered in the months that have passed since I've seen it, rewatching it again, that happened exactly the way that they burned into my head. So much so that it is difficult to come back to, which is kind of a unique thing when a movie is so good at what it's doing, but what it's doing is so awful that it's hard to rewatch. And it really deserves it. It's an interesting relationship to have with a film. DoubleFeatureShow.com is what I was going to say. Go to DoubleFeatureShow.com. We have other movies on there, other Jim Mickle stuff you can look up. The email is DoubleFeatureShow@iCloud.com. You can email us, talk to us about movies or something else, I guess. And the executive producers this time around are Liam Duffy, Greg Winter, Seth Hanasek, and Matthew Berry. Those people are going to expect you to tell them what movies are coming next time on the show.
Oh man, not only am I going to tell them what movies are coming up next time on the show, but I'm going to tell them that we are beginning year 7's journey.
All right.
And it is a journey into a place I've never been. It's something interesting. We're going to do something director-centric.
All right.
Which is exciting for you and I regarding the journey. But it's also something that I think is interesting in that we're going to, by being director-centric and dealing with 6 movies from each of these directors, we're going to be able to dive into the people versus the art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a really important aspect to these two guys. So we're going to be doing Woody Allen's Annie Hall, and we're going to be pairing that with the first of Spike Lee's Brooklyn movies, She's Gotta Have It.
So Death to Double Feature?
Death to Double Feature, and watch more fucking film.
Bye.